Okay, so as I said, good afternoon and Erev Tov. We're so happy all of you could join us today for the first in Dr. Ganzel's series, From the End of the Kingdom of Judah to the Return to Zion. We're so pleased we could have Dr. Tova Ganzel here today. She is a senior lecturer of Jewish Studies, the head of the Kramim Jewish Studies Honors Program at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Dr. Ganzel has published on prophetic literature with a specialization in the book of Ezekiel. Her book, Destruction and Restoration in the Seer's Prophecy, Studies in the Prophecies of Ezekiel, was published in both Hebrew and in English. Dr. Ganzel was the director of the Midrashah at Bar-Ilan University and is one of the first trained women's halachic advisors, a yoetzot halacha. That deserves a round of applause, in my opinion. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Ganzel. Thank you all for being here. Have a wonderful shiur.
Thank you very much, Shira, for that really nice introduction. And thank you everyone for being with me here tonight or today. I didn't realize that this was also geared to an Israeli audience, I admit, but that's also nice. I'll give a brief intro and then we'll talk about what we're going to talk about in the coming hour and this series. This series is actually preparing us for the 3 weeks that'll come in between Shivaser B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, soon, in about a month and a half or 2 months, for counting until the end. And what we'll be doing is we'll actually be looking at different biblical texts to try to create a picture that analyzes the situation that actually brought Israel to the temple being destroyed in the last years of the temple standing, the like really last 12 years of the temple standing, and then discussing a little bit what happened after the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem, what happened in Egypt, what happened in Babylon, what happened when the Persian Empire took over and became the dominant empire, and really back until the days of the return to Zion. So basically, we're talking about a time that there's no one biblical book that describes. It's really more about the final chapters, or the final last two chapters, I could say, in the book of Kings, the final two or three chapters in the book of Divrei Hayamim, the Chronicles, and then the prophetic literature that gives us another in other additional insights. First, when we talk about the destruction of the kingdom of Judah, it's obviously Ezekiel, Yechezkel, and Jeremiah, and Yirmiyahu. And then, as we come along into the return to Zion, we're looking at Haggai, at Zechariah, we'll look a little bit at Malachi, at Daniel, and we'll finally finish with the book of Esther, which is really after the return to Zion, but just to close up the biblical period. We'll also be looking a little bit at extra biblical sources. We'll see what we can learn from archaeological findings and in what ways that gives us insight to this period. So that's a brief background. We'll be going slowly week by week, proceeding in chronological order, where the point where I want to start with is really the Babylonian rise. And we are talking now 605 BCE. There are a few years, we won't be discussing a whole bunch of years throughout these 6 weeks. And the years that I'll discuss, I'll kind of try to repeat. But I really think that when we talk about the temple being destroyed and the exilic period in Yehuda, our turning point is really when the Assyrian Empire falls and the Babylonian Empire rises. I purposely brought here a few pictures. Does everyone see my PowerPoint presentation? Shira, is it okay? Okay. So what I brought here are really the classical pictures of the temples of the Babylonian temples that you will see if you will Google Babylon in the Neo-Babylonian period, which is what we are talking about. We're talking about a empire which was in, I would say, objective descriptions, very, very minimal in its influence on the history of the world in the ancient Near Eastern context. So, and what we see in the Bible, or what we see in the Tanakh, or what we see in our own history, is actually very different from what a historian would say about this period. And let me try to explain a little bit why. When we look at the Assyrian Empire, we're talking about a huge empire that succeeded over hundreds of years to conquer many, many lands and to be extremely influential. And that's why a lot of the Book of Kings, of Sefer Melachim, and a lot of almost all, I would say, of the prophecies in the Book of Yeshayahu, the prophecies in the Book of Hosea, the prophecies in the Book of Amos, they all deal with this amazing empire that was extremely influential on the world. And as part of its general influence on the world, it also exiled the Northern Kingdom, the 10 tribes, in 722 BCE. When we're looking at the Babylonian Empire, from a historical point of view, this was a very short, brief time in history when the Babylonian Empire was influential. It came up 605 BCE. It didn't have to do a lot in order to be well off as far as running a whole empire, because as opposed to the Assyrian Empire that had to conquer country by country, country by country, and kind of make sure that they get control over large pieces of land all around what would be the ancient Near Eastern world, the Babylonian Empire just had to conquer the main cities of Ashur. And once they did that and the main temples, then the whole empire was actually considered to be under their control. This happened in 605 BCE, after a period about 5 or 6 years after the Assyrian Empire fell. There was a settled war trying to figure out who would be the next empire. Egypt kind of was hoping it would be them. This Egyptian option was very substantial when we look at our history in Yehuda, because it misled some of the Yehuda kings to think that they should actually collaborate with the Egyptians, thinking that they will take over against Yirmiyahu's warning. And really, it was the Babylonian Empire. What's very substantial to understand is that by 538, Persian Empire was already in control. What that basically means is what we call bruto, the maximum amount of years that the Babylonian Empire had, were give or take 70 years from 605 to 538. And I will say carefully that the first few years, it took them quite a while to get control. And the last 10 years were, or even more, 15 years, they were already declining. So they had a very short amount of time, a very short few decades, where they were really powerful. And even then, it wasn't to the extent that the Assyrian Empire was ever, or that the Persian Empire after them was ever. That being said, is the exact opposite notion of what we get in when we learn Tanakh, when we learn about the first temple being destroyed. Because in those few years that the Babylonian Empire was in control, the one thing that they significantly succeeded to do that the Assyrian Empire did never succeeded to do was to conquer Jerusalem. Why did I give this as an introduction to what we're learning? Because a lot of what we'll discuss in the coming few weeks is, at least the first part of the weeks, is why were the people in Jerusalem so misled and so confident that the temple would never fall? It had different reasons. But if we're looking on a realistic level, then their understanding was that they survived the Assyrian Empire, which was much greater and larger and stronger, and succeeded in many more parts of the world to capture countries, even in distant places from their capital city. So why should they think that the Babylonian Empire will succeed in a place that the Assyrian Empire didn't succeed? That seemed, and against the will of God, that seemed totally not realistic. Now I want to add to that something that we see here in the pictures. When I look for pictures for the Assyrian Empire, I can tell you in a brief search on the web, there are a lot of briefs. And if you go to the British Museum, you'll see there are very, very many. I'll just say one comment because I see someone wrote in the chat that Amos doesn't mention Ashul. It doesn't mention him directly, but it definitely the prophecies there are definitely indirectly mentioned that are connected to the Assyrian Empire. But I'm just, for now on, I'll try to answer questions, let's say every 15 minutes or so, okay, in a concentrated way, or 20 minutes. What I started saying was that if I would look for pictures for the Assyrian Empire or even the Persian Empire later, there are many of them because they were extremely powerful, extremely significant, and left a huge influence around the world. And I started saying that if you go to the British Museum, you'll see many reliefs of the Assyrian Empire all over, the different kings, each of them was had their own palaces, colorful, dramatic, very, very big pictures. We see it in Sennacherib, Ashur Banipal. Really, we see it across the board for all the Assyrian kings. When you try to look for pictures or reliefs or texts of Nebuchadnezzar, there's one. I'll show it to you later. There's another broken stone. There's very little of what they had left for the world, the Babylonians. If you go to the British Museum and you come and you ask, where's the Babylonian Empire exhibit? You'll find 2.5 things maybe. Meaning this notion that the Babylonian Empire was strong and therefore, I think someone here should be muted. Maybe I'll mute everyone if I... Oh, okay. Sorry, I just muted where I saw there was noise. I apologize for taking control here. Anyway, what I started saying was that it's not coincidental that if you go into a place like any worldwide museum and you look for the Babylonian evidence, archaeological findings, diggings, whatever it is, you'll find very, very minimal evidence. And that is represents well the short amount of time that the Babylonian Empire was influential. Now, we can discuss for a minute on a theological level why it makes sense for God to send an empire that clearly didn't have such a large impact around the world to tear down our temple. And I'll elaborate a little bit more about it in the coming few lessons, but I'll already say as a starting point that if the Assyrian Empire would have destroyed our temple, it would have magnified the fact that the Assyrian king is a very strong king, is capable of conquering the whole world, and obviously our temple and God couldn't succeed to give a fair fight against him, and that's why he conquered our temple. That could be a realistic conclusion. But when you send a god that the Marduk or Nabu or the Neo-Babylonian gods that are very that their influence is extremely minimal around the world, and their success to conquer new territories is non-existent or very minimal, and their recognition around the world is not as a huge god at all, or not as a god that succeeded to take control for hundreds of years, it makes a much clearer understanding that the reason our temple was destroyed by the Babylonian empire is because that's what Hashem wanted. That was carrying out the God of Israel's will, the God of Judah's will, that decided that time had come for his own temple to be destroyed. I'll say one more sentence before we move on, and I will also say that in addition to that, it's important to note that the general notion in the world at that time is that a strong God can make sure his temple is not destroyed. And a God that's not strong or can't really succeed in being substantial is a God that doesn't have any control or can't come against the larger God that destroys his temple. The notion that Hashem would want his own temple destroyed is non-existent in the ancient Near Eastern world, which is why it's so obvious that it's not something that the Israelites or Am Yisrael would even assume to be possible, if not because they didn't deserve their temple, because that's really what becomes when you say Chilul Shem Hashem. When you desecrate God's name, it's really you burn down the temple. That means Hashem, in the eyes of the ancient Near Eastern concepts world and what's recognized, Hashem is not even strong enough to, I would say, keep his own temple existing. So there's nothing bigger than a chilul Hashem that can be understood than really Hashem's temple being destroyed, not because of the acts of the people, not because of the people being exiled, but just by the fact that that symbolizes to the world, to anyone looking, oh, this is a God that's not really almighty. This one's not really a strong one. This one can't be so influential. He couldn't even make sure that his own temple wouldn't be destroyed. So that's a general notion. That's in the ancient Near Eastern world we're talking about. And from here, I want to talk just one more minute about what are the common temples that we see in Babylonian in Babylonian at that time. So what you can see here on the screen is what we call the Sagila, the temple dedicated to Marduk, the protector god of Babylon. And I just brought it here so you really connect a little bit to the concept that a large temple really demonstrates a strong god. This notion will be changed and will be, I would say, shifted a little bit when the Persian Empire comes about. And when we talk about the Persian Empire in about three or four classes, then we will definitely compare this temple that I discussed now and the notion that Marduk is really the one to be in control of the world, and the expectation of the Babylonian kings that anyone everywhere in their empire recognizes Marduk as the main god. I'll say one other thing. When we talk about this, is again just so we understand what is the climax that we're talking about. When I talk about the Babylonian temples, I depend a lot on, for instance, this is a good example, the remains of the Azida temple, which you see here, of course, Sipa. They have really provided, like I wrote here, considerable information on the rituals performed in the temples of Babylon. And just to note that we're talking really about the same years, because we're now going to start, as we said, at 605 BCE. These temples were active from the middle of the 8th century BCE, and we know that they continued at least till 484 BCE. That means that they were first controlled by the Assyrian Empire, and then they were controlled by the Babylonian temple, by the Babylonian Empire. And this is also what the exiles that will be exiled to Babylonia, which we will discuss today, met when they were exiled, meaning it's to understand the context of the Jews when the temple was destroyed, we have to understand a little bit about how Babylonian was seen in Israel, but also what did the exiles who were exiled to Babylon see when they reached there. So this gives us a little bit of insights to what we'll see in Babel. So after we talked about the 605 conquer of Babylon, of the Assyrian Empire, the first time that we really, it becomes very significant to us in Israel is before the Jehoiakim exile. It's already in the days of Jehoiakim, which we will see the verses in a minute. But the next turning point, and I said we'll talk about a few substantial years. So if we talked about 605 was when the Babylonian Empire conquered the Assyrian Empire, then the next substantial turning point is really when the King Jehoiachin was exiled to Babylonia. And you can see here, I put a line here on the right. What we're talking about as far as the kings in Yehuda. Just so we have a very basic timeline. Here's Chizkiah the king, Menasheh the king, Amon the king, and Yoshiah. Here already we have the fall of this is all after the fall of the northern kingdom. So we only have one kingdom, the Yehuda kingdom. These are the kings, Chizkiah, Menasheh, Amon, Yoshiah, Yoyakim. Yoyakim comes about, is the king, is the ruler when Babel, 605, when Babel conquers the Assyrian Empire. He falls, we'll see it in a minute in the Psukim. Comes Yoyakim, he rules for a very short amount of time. He's exiled here to Babylonia. We see the route he took. And then we'll come to Tzidkiyahu, that was the last king of Yehuda. That's just to give us a time frame. So basically, we're talking about, when we talk about King Yoyachin, we're talking about like one king before the last. He was exiled here to Babylon. You can see that he went, the exile always takes place by the way that, with the route that there's water sources, which is why no one crosses like this. Can you see my mouse when I move it? So no one crosses the desert, obviously. You go like this. This is where all the water, you see the Nahal Plat is here, and that's how all the Golim were always exiled in all generations because of the water sources. So I'll stop for hit and I'll ask if there are questions, and then we'll go on. So if anyone wants to unmute themselves and ask something briefly, I'll be glad to answer. That was just to set the stage and to give us the necessary background to understand the world we're going to talk about.
How long was the Assyrian Empire in power?
That's a very good question, Naomi, right? Definitely a few hundred years. It's a good question because the Assyrian Empire, as I said before, conquered the world gradually. So if you want to say when were they influential in Israel, that's a different question than asking when were they in power. So we hear of them in Israel somewhere approximately in the middle of the 9th century BCE, 850 or so. But that's not when they became powerful. That's just when the Book of Kings starts telling us stories that mention Shalmaneser, you know, that mentioned the first of the Assyrian kings that reached our area, but they were powerful for many more years. It's just they expanded gradually. Yes, Ashkel. Nice. Sorry, you're raising your hand. So
could you go back one slide so I can? Can you go back one slide?
Esther, I don't see it, but I understand you're asking something. So okay. Here.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Did you want to ask something about this?
No, I just wanted to take it down. Okay. Thank you.
Usher, I'm with you.
If your premise about destroying temples, showing power is correct, why in heaven's name did Nebuchadnezzar not destroy our temple the first time he conquered Jerusalem? He didn't destroy the temple. He carefully preserved it, and he took he took some booty and some of the kalim with him along with the exiles, but he didn't destroy the temple. It wasn't until 11 years later when he got ticked off that they had rebelled against him that he came back, reconquered Jerusalem, and only then destroyed the temple.
So that's an excellent question. I meant to address it shortly, but I'll already address it now, and I will say that there are two answers for that question. The first answer has to do with the question of what happens after you destroy a temple. After you destroy a temple, you have to be sure you can actually hold on to that part of the land and be in control of it, and make sure that you're clearly in charge. When Nebuchadnezzar came for the first time, he was a young king who had just come up to, who had just been appointed king, and he's putting Yoyakim to be there as someone who was under his what we call in Hebrew ben chasut, meaning under his authority, was supposed to set the stage to a situation where if he doesn't rebel, meaning if Yoyakim wouldn't rebel, then that would have been enough, at least for this, at this part of Nebuchadnezzar's kingship, to really gain control and access. Meaning, we see it also in the Assyrian Empire. Not every time they reached a land did they do for the first time really destroy the temple. They always first tried to put in a system that made it clear that whoever was there was under their control. That historians write, and this is not my explanation, I'm here basing on historians, that gives them much better what we would call today misim, taxes, because the people in the land are not all burned down. The slaves still exist. They're still raising agriculture. They can still give on a regular basis taxes to the kingdom, meaning the king has a lot, many things to gain by the place, especially if it's distant from his main capital, still being functioning in a way that also recognizes his authority, but also self-sustainable, sending on a regular basis taxes and other goods to the main kingdom. That's what I would say on a earthly level. That's what historians would tell you. If you would read the prophetic literature, obviously, b'mishol ha'eloki, in the godly level, then Am Yisrael was still not at the point where they deserved for the temple to be destroyed. Meaning, Hashem really decided that the temple gets to be destroyed at a certain point when the cup became full, if to use the prophetic images, or when their doings were as such that there was really no sikui, no chance that they deserved another chance. So basically, I think a good answer to your question is a combination of the Mishor Arzi and the Mishor Eloki. What I said at first would reflect what historians or realistic people that evaluate the events based on what could or couldn't he do? Well, they would say that he couldn't do it right away. He had to gain more power and understand that they're rebelling and this is not working for it to be worthwhile for him to burn down the temple. And I will say more about it after when we reach Retzach Gedalia and we see what happens, what the alternatives were. And b'mishor Eloki, it's when Hashem decided the temple would be destroyed, which was not at 597, but only at 586. I see Yehudi.
May I ask?
Yes.
Okay. I have two questions. Question one, if it's really true that the main thing or a substantial thing was destroying the temple, then why when they burned down Shomron did they completely neglect Beit Deor where the temple was? Basically, that would have been a much more important thing to do, but they don't bother with Beit Deor at all. They let it stand. Beit Deor still involved in Yoshio's time. You know, it's still active as a temple in Yoshio's time, and Yoshio has to make a special effort to knock it off. That's question one. Question two, I wrote in the chat, is I understand what you're saying about the Babylonians and the Assyrians, that the Assyrians were more a bigger enterprise. But the Tanakh doesn't seem to say it that way. If you read Yechezkel, they make Babel to be equal to Ashur or worse. And then not only that, they proceed to think that Babel's going to conquer Mitzrayim just like Ashur did. Now, that doesn't mean Babel really did conquer Mitzrayim, but they sort of thought that was going to happen. So you would never know from reading Tanakh that this was the case. Another point about burning temples, etc., is, you know, the British burnt down the White House in 1814. So what? In other words, it's what the people make out of it rather than the objective reality.
Nahon. Okay, so I'll answer briefly, and I'm already saying I'll take one or two more questions, and then we'll move on for now. So your question as far as Beit El has to do, again, with what was recognized as a place that had political power. This may have been a religious point that was substantial for Yehuda, for Nashim B'Yehuda, for Judahites, but it obviously wasn't, and that's the way it's also pursued in the biblical texts or the prophetic literature, I would say, but it just wasn't a place that it seemed to be substantial enough for to make the extra effort. So that's a brief answer to that. As far as the way that the empires are situated, I would say viewed of in the biblical passages, the reason I made the introduction is exactly because of the point you're making rightfully, which is that in the biblical eyes, Babylon, which destroyed our temple, gets a full stage because it doesn't matter how big or small someone is and how many countries they conquer. To us, what matters is only whether they're judged on one parameter alone, which is, especially in the prophetic literature, which is, did they destroy our temple or did they not? The reason I set the stage the way I understand it historically is because I want us to understand when we go through the verses, what was alternative narrative? Meaning we hear the prophet saying this and this is going to happen, this and this is going to happen, this and this is going to happen. We don't really get, the newspaper that was common among the non-elites or the non-prophetic literature or those who didn't believe in God or those who kept rebelling. So the only way we could tell the other story or understand the people that the prophets were talking to was a little bit from their quotes. And we'll see some quotes, the prophets quoting those that came against them here and there, bits and pieces. But it's also from putting together what the historical reality really looked like from texts that were found that really describe the ancient Near Eastern world from other perspectives. And for your really last point, I just agree that it's not a question of an objective analysis of whether how important it was for any empire that a temple was burnt or not. It's really the story you make of it, which is why we're sitting here 2,500 years later and talking about the event that happened then, because it's our story. So I definitely second that third point too. So I said I would take two more questions. Someone asked here in the chat if Yoyachin and Yoyakim are the same people. No, they're not. You can look here in our chart and you can see we have Yehoyakim first and then Yehoyachin, and we'll see it in the verses that we'll look at in a minute. Did Assyria ever conquer Egypt, and by who and when was what else? By whom and when and what was the source? No, they never really succeeded in conquering Egypt. So they reached Egypt, but they never had control over it. And that's part of what Ezekiel and Jeremiah and other prophecies discuss. It caused a lot of frustration to the Nevi'im. How is it that there is an empire right around the corner that escaped from these empires that never succeeded in conquering them? It's also, by the way, true about Tyre, which I don't know if we'll have time to talk about, but there were these alternatives around in the world around them that got them extremely frustrated. I think I answered all the questions. One last question and we'll move on. Does anyone want to ask one last question or is that it? Okay. Yeah. I thought I heard someone.
Yeah, I said that. Didn't they Sacha don't conquer Egypt around 670 and kept control of it for about 10 or 15 years?
That's negotiated among scholars. The common understanding is that he reached Egypt but didn't really have total control over it. So the word control is a little misleading because there is a whole spectrum of what could be called control, from making you give me taxes until making sure that you obey my or understand my religious rituals and God, that you have got the Assyrian Empire, for example, which had a very hard control at sometimes and many times, actually made the lands that were under their control put mizbachot and gods of their that resembled their gods, Ashur, around the empire, which we could see in Sefer Melachim in different ways, and the prophet's response to that. So the word control is a little tricky, but I am going to move on because I'm looking at the watch. And after we had set the stage for understanding really the situation, let's look at the psukim. I didn't take the whole chapter 24 in the Book of Kings because of our lack of time. I strongly recommend you read the whole chapter thoroughly before next week, but if you want to complement what we're studying, but I just took the main psukim. I need a brief answer here, Shira, if I see you. Are you used to reading the psukim in English and in Hebrew? Only in English, only in Hebrew? What works in this crowd? Since this is a general question from now and on, just tell me what you're used to. I can't hear you.
Both.
We have a mix.
English.
It's very helpful to have both. We do have a mixed crowd. So if you can.
Okay, perfect. I just wanted to know because. Okay, fine. Honestly, I'll tell you that doing both takes more time, but I will definitely do my best to do so. So, Biyamav, the first verse that I'm starting, it is the days of Jehoiakim, which, as I said before, is not the same for Jehoiachin. And he was the king that kinged, or ruled, I would say, Biyamav ala Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. In his days, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came up. And here is a great example of what I said before, that one king controlling a land has different levels of control, and it's not either I control you or not. He came here. Yoyakim was his servant for 3 years. Being his servant means that he recognized that he has to pay his taxes, that he's not independent. It had different the different outcomes, the fact that he was an Evid. He didn't like it. Now, we don't see here Yirmiyahu, but if I would put here the psukim of Yirmiyahu, we would see how much time and effort Yirmiyahu spent trying to convince Yehoiakim not to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. But if I want to for a minute be... if I have to hear, maybe make a point to honor Jehoiakim, which from historical perspectives, it seems unreasonable. How come you went against Nebuchadnezzar? What are you looking for? Trouble? Why couldn't you just stay with this status quo where this is a situation that you get the whatever taxes you want? And on the other hand, you give us independent and you leave our temple untouched. And the answer is exactly what I said when I opened the series, which is in these years at 605, it seemed, and even until 597, it seemed that the Babylonian Empire was not such a big deal. They had just conquered the Assyrian Empire. It seemed like in 1 minute, maybe the Egyptians will conquer the whole empire. They weren't such a known empire. They didn't have so much power, and they weren't recognized as such a frightening empire that you shouldn't rebel. So as I said before, when we look at it from a historical perspective, a few years later, and this also answers the question I was asked before, when you look at it from a historical perspective, you say, well, both sides we can question. Why didn't, like I was asked before, why didn't Nebuchadnezzar just destroy the temple already and that's it? And on the other hand, why does Jehoiakim rebel? What is he looking for trouble? And it's the same exact answer for both questions. Nebuchadnezzar had just regained power. He was a young king. He hadn't had the record that the Assyrians had. And these were like his first steps. These was like a milestone steps in his starting to become substantial. So that's that now we understand where that the Babylonian Empire wasn't so dominant in these years around the world and didn't have such a strong reputation, which is why Jehoiakim thought, here, God Hashem will now be recognized around the world. Here's my opportunity to be totally independent. But no, and then the verses go on saying, I skipped a few verses here, Vaishkav Jehoiakim im avotav, Vaimloch Jehoiakim lo tachtav. Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, meaning he died, and his son Jehoiachin succeeded him as the king. By the way, all these translations are from Sepharia. I'm not taking responsibility for the level of English translation. I just used what was easy for me to access. Velo sifod melech mitzrayim, latzet me'artzo. Now, note something that I put here on our screen, just so you understand that the Babylonian Empire is starting to become more noticeable and substantial, because the king of Egypt, that once thought that maybe he would be able to be an alternative to the Babylonian Empire, understands that the Babylonian Empire is becoming still run full force, and to the extent that the Egyptian king, as opposed to Joachim, learned his lesson and didn't try to budge and didn't try to move out forward. And that's why it says that he didn't leave his country. Ki lakach melech Bavel min nechel Mitzrayim, meaning the king of Babylonian started to really control more land, to be more influential. Ad nahar Prat, and you can see it here, from the Wadi of Egypt to the river of the Euphrates. Kol asher hayta lemelech Mitzrayim. Again, that's why I said before that the word control is a tricky word. It doesn't mean that he conquered their temples or that he removed the king. As you can see, Melech Mitzrayim is still here. The king of Egypt is still here. It just means that the king of Babylon is gaining power. And here is where we start our class. Ben 18 shana Yoyachin b'molcho. Yoyachin was 18. He was very young. Sorry, he was a very young king. V'shlosha chodashim malach b'Yerushalayim. And he only was ruling for 3 months. And we even has his mother's name, which is pretty extraordinary. For who asked me before, here comes the, if I said there's a Mishor Arzi and a Mishor Eloki, there's a rational level, and there's also what we would say the way Hashem dominates the world. Here's the reason for the time that he deserved to be exiled, because he was displeasing the Lord, just as his father has done. Ba'etahi, in those days, alu avdei Nebuchadnezzar melech bavel Yerushalayim, batavo ha'ir b'matzor. So now we already understand, I'm going back for 1 minute, that if we had, first time Nebuchadnezzar came around here was here, ba'amavara Nebuchadnezzar melech bavel v'yir yoyakim evet shalosh anim. The first time Nebuchadnezzar came around, Yoyakim was here. Then comes the second time when Yoyachim doesn't go in the way, it doesn't do what he should do as far as worshiping Hashem. Ba'etahi, in those days, alu avdei Nebuchadnezzar melech bavel, I'm sorry, I see there's a problem here with English, Yerushalayim, batavoi b'matzor, and he put the city under siege. Ve'evo Nebuchadnezzar melech bavel al ha'ir v'avadav tzorim aleh. So he didn't just come and go. First, he put the city under siege. What do we see next? Vayetzeo Yachin Melech Yehuda al Melech Bavel. Now, this, he doesn't repeat the mistake that Yoyakim did before. What do I mean? He didn't try to fight. We're talking about a young king. He's there for 3 months. He learned his lesson. What he wants is really what you would call today to pick up a white flag. He picks up a white flag, and what he basically says is, I'm here, and take me to exile, and in a nice words, I would say, let's move on from here without really destroying the temple. And that's exactly what the verses tell us. Ve'etzeo Yachin Melech Yehuda, thereupon King of Yoyachin of Yehuda, along with his mother and his Ve'avadav, Ve'sarav, Ve'sarisav, everyone, all the officers and everyone with him. Ve'ikach oto Melech Bavel b'shnat shmona l'molcho. Okay, so he leaves. And this is Bishnat Shmona Lemolcho. This is the 8th year of the Babylonian king's kingdom, right? Because Yoyachin is only there for a few months. It's not the 8th year of Yoyachin, like we might misunderstand here. It's the 8th year. It's the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar, which again, we were at 605 when, you know, the Babylonian rule started. Now we're now at a 597, and here we are. Vayotze misham et kol otzot bet Hashem veotzot bet Hamelech veikatzetz et kol klei hazav asher asa Shlomo Melech Yisrael. Beichal Hashem kasher diber Hashem. So he took out from Jerusalem all the treasures of the house of Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He stripped off all the golden decorations in the temple of the Lord, which King Solomon of Israel had made as the Lord warned. This again belongs to the category that I said before. You can already see that he's more confident and he does more to strip down the temple from its content. And we'll go back to that soon. ויגלה את כל ירושלים ואת כל השרים ואת כל גיבורי החיל, 10,000 גולה וכל החרש והמסגר לרישר זולת עלת המארץ. Now, the prophet Yechezkel was exiled exactly in this pasuk. Why am I mentioning it? Because, you know, when you study Yirmiyahu, for example, you have a recognition of Yirmiyahu out of the book of Yirmiyahu. The book of Kings mentions him, so we know more about him than what his book says. But when you study the book of Yechezkel, unfortunately, we don't know anything more than what the book of Yechezkel says. Yechezkel is not mentioned anywhere in the Tanakh, anywhere in the Bible, which is not the book of Yechezkel itself. So I'm saying this with, smiling, but I'm saying if you want to find Yechezkel out of the book of Yechezkel, look for him in this pasuk where it says, "Vehigla et kol Yerushalayim," that he exiled all of Jerusalem, "Veet kol asarim," and all the commanders, "Veet kol gibore achayim," and all the people that were what you would call today the top of the industry, the top, you know, the people who really run the country. "V'chol acharash v'amasgir" is like saying you take all the military officers, anyone that can make any weapons, anyone who's capable of really rebelling will be now exiled. Zulat da'alat ha'aretz, the poorest people were left. And among them, in this sentence, it should also say the Kohen Yechezkel. Ve'yagel Yehoyachin bavela ve'item ha'melech ve'it nashe ha'melech ve'it tzoriseh ve'it elei ha'aretz. So again, we see he deported everyone to Babylon, the king, his officers, his wife, anyone who was substantial, as I said before, anyone who could rebel. ואת כל אנשי החיל, 7,000 והחרש והמסגר, כל גיבורים עושי מלחמה. They were talking about several thousand people, all those that were trained to battle. Now what he does is, he basically puts a different king, which is a very interesting choice. וימלך מלך בבל את מתניה דודו תחתיו, ויסב את שמו צדקיהו. What we learn from the choice here of the Babylonian king to put Mataniah, to put someone from the heritage of the Yehuda kings of Malchut Beit David, continue the lineage from the same family, which is basically Dodo would make him a brother of Yehoiakim, to continue ruling, basically means he understands the importance of the country being controlled by the dynasty that's recognized as the in Yehuda as who should be the king of the land. But he doesn't, it's not a okay, fine, now do what you want. By changing his name, he's basically making a very clear statement about who's the rule here. You know, when the Ethiopians Jews came to Israel in 91 and 92, the people in Misrad HaPnim took the liberty to many times say across Ethiopian Jews and tell them, oh, your name is so-and-so. That's a very complicated name in Israel. Why don't you become Sarah? And this name, oh, we never heard of this name. I don't even know how to spell it. Why don't you become Leah? Well, you and you, why don't you become? And it's very interesting to see that if you look at it today, 20 years later, a lot of these people who were then in their graduates in elementary school or high school or whatever are rebelling against that change and going back to their Ethiopian names. And why am I giving this as an example? Because what they're basically saying is when you changed my name, you took control over my identity. You took control over my life. You took away something of who I am, of my story. Who are you to decide that this and this name is a complicated one and call me Sarah? I'm purposely not saying any names because I don't want to here be, to frame any name or anyone. But what I want to say is that a name is something very significant and it has a deep meaning of who you are. So I'm not comparing the Ethiopian Drake to the Babylonian king, the Kidim and Misad Apnim to, you know, the Babylonian king, but in a way I am, because I'm saying when you change Tzidkiyahu's name and you, when Mataniah's name, and you say you're from now Tzidkiyahu, you're basically saying you're going to do as I say, including your name, meaning you're going to sign the documents saying that you're under me. You're going to use the name I gave you to represent yourself in anywhere and in any situation. And that is very substantial. It's not just a technical thing. Like I said, like we can see 20 years later from a perspective. So someone here just asked me in the chat about the 7,000 numbers, and is that an exaggeration? So I will just note that some people say it's an it's not an exaggeration, but it's too minimal, and it's actually usually looked at as what we call a mispar typologi, typological, is that how you say it in English, number, meaning seven represents something whole, 7,000 represents something in completion. It's basically trying to say anyone who is part of the top notch society of the army, top army officers, they were all taken. Anyone that could work with in any way that could make any kind of neshek, anything that had to do with battles. I just want to move on. And I want to say that the really what's very substantial in these years, in our understanding, I'm just having a hard time following the chat, so I apologize. In our understanding, what happened in Babylon to those 7,000 or however many people that were exiled, is really given to us by a narrative that's within the book of Yechezkel, which we will talk about for a few minutes today and then start with next week, God willing, which is the prophet who lived, and I wrote here at least 25 years in Babylon. Why did I write at least 25 years? Because we know from the opening of the book that it says that he starts prophesizing 5 years after he was exiled, and that he was exiled with the Jehoiachin exiles. So that's why I know that he was exiled at 597 BCE. I wrote 573 because that's the latest date in the book. It's mentioned in the opening verses of the prophetic section in chapters 40 to 48. It's actually also mentioned in another place within the book in the prophets to the nations. That doesn't mean that that's his latest prophecy. It just means that it's the latest dated prophecy. So I know that he was in Babel. Substantial as an active prophet for, if it's from the fifth year of the Babylonian exile until the 25th year of the Babylonian exile, for at least two decades and probably even more, because not all prophecies have dates. What that gives us is a very substantial point of view to what was going, what the exiles were going through and how they viewed what was happening in Israel. And also, if when we compare Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, who are two prophets that prophesized in the same exact years, meaning not Yirmiyahu started earlier, but at least some of the time that Yirmiyahu prophesied was also parallel to the time that Ezekiel prophesied, then we basically can compare two narratives which are extremely substantial. The narratives of those who kept living in Israel after the Galut of Yehoiachin, after the Jehoiachin exile, until the temple was destroyed and also afterwards. That's Yirmiyahu, until the last of the people go to Egypt and what happens then. And in Yechezkel, we have more than two decades of what happened to the exiles that sat in Babylon while all this was happening in Jerusalem, which is why this is so substantial. So the most substantial thing, and with that's what we'll end with today. Shira, we end at 8, right? Is And I will say one word of introductory, and then I think it'll be clearer. The most substantial thing that Ezekiel has to do in the years that are before the temple was destroyed, and here it is in English, is really to convince the people that are around him that God has left the temple. Meaning, we're not, in Ezekiel's eyes, we're not talking about two populations, one in Israel that has an existing temple with God dwelling within it, and a group of exiles that are now departed from God. But what Ezekiel's telling us already, 7 years before the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem, from the fifth year of he was exiled, is exactly this. I will go back to the Hebrew and then to the English. There are a few verses that I chose from the 10th chapter in the book. We won't see all the details in the Pesukim, but what you can see here is Vayibet Tzavoto et ha'ish levush abadim. He sees a man dressed in clothes. Take fire from what Galgal is part of the description of God that we see also in the first, in the chapter of the Kiryat, in the first chapter of the book. It's a way to hint to God. Mi beinot lekuvim, from the kuvim. Veishlach hakuv et yado mi beinot lekuvim el ha'esh asher beinot hakuvim veisa veiten el chofnei levush abadim veikach veyetze. Vayeromu hakuvim, hi achaya asher ha'iti benahar kvar. Vayetze kvod Hashem me'al miftan habayit ve'amod al hakuvim. Ve'amod petach shar beit Hashem hakadmoni uchvod Elohei Yisrael alehem milemala. He ha'chaya sh'ra'iti tachat Elohei Yisrael b'nehar kvar, va'eda kichuvim hema, asher'iti anahar kvar mar'ehem. So let's see it now in English. We're really talking about Yechezkel describing God leaving the temple, and you could see it in these verses. When he commanded the man dressed in linen, take fire from among the crews within the wheelwork, he went in and stood beside a wheel. Again, as I said before, that's part of the descriptions of God. And the kerub stretched out his hand among the kerubs to the fire that was among the kerubs. He took some and put it into the hands of him who was clothed in linen, who took it and went out. The kerubs ascended. Those were the creatures that I had seen by the Kvar River. Why is he noting that? To say that he wants to make it clear for his audience to understand that he's really talking about the God that I described in such detail in the first chapter. That's the presence of the Lord that I see leaving. The presence of the Lord left the platform of the house and stopped above the crews. And they stopped at the entrance of the eastern gate of the house of the Lord with the presence of God of Israel above them. They were the same creatures that I had seen below the God of Israel at the Kvar River. So now I knew that they were Krubs, and from their faces, they were the very faces I had seen. I had seen them by the Kvar River. What do we see here? What we see here is a description that we'll start with, God willing, next week, where basically we are looking at the prophet Yechezkel doing his best to convince the people that are around him, the exiles, that God had left the temple in Jerusalem. It's not a temple that's built with God's presence in it that he's looking at, or that he's part of when he's prophesizing to Jerusalem, or that the Jerusalemites live around thinking God's still dwelling within them. It's a temple that's been emptied out from God's glory. And I'll finish saying that now we understand the Haftarah we read in Shavuot, the very detailed description of God in the first chapter of Yechezkel is so substantial and so important, not on its own merits, but because that is exactly the way that Yechezkel could later, a few chapters down the road, convince the people that he knows exactly what he's talking about when he says God's left the temple. He knows because he gave us a detailed description of God that was never seen before in the prophetic literature. And now we can trust him when he's describing God left the temple, because he definitely knows God, what God looked like. And this is the exact God that he saw there when he came to Bavel. And it's this God that he saw departing from the temple, leaving the Kruvim, and taking a journey outside of Jerusalem. So next week, we'll look at this journey a little bit more in detail and why it's substantial for the Jerusalem inhabitants and also for the Babylonian ones. And we will also see the direct and indirect dialogue of the two communities, one in Jerusalem and one in Babylon, arguing where is God situated now and which one of them is the one that's going to continue the Jewish nation. That's it for today. Any brief questions I'll be glad to answer. I can do it briefly. Bisimcha.
I have a question.
Yes.
At that time, Yirmiyahu, was he prophesizing that Hashem was still in the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim?
That's an excellent question that we'll start with next week.
Okay.
So you have to come back. It's on my slides for next week.
Okay, yes, thank you.
I just want to know, I know I'll have to miss the third class. How do I get the tape, the recording?
Shira, I'm forwarding that to you.
Thank you.